Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking about making your web pages go faster by using the Varnish Cache. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral. Episode 390, recorded May 31st, 2016. Varnish Cache. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Synonge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be wanting to play with right after the show. That happens a lot for me. Projects you may be using every day and not aware of it. And I bet that's also true about this particular show. And we'll explain that in a few minutes. Well, we'll first be joined by our lovely and talented co-host, Guillermo Amaral. Guillermo, welcome right back to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
It's been a long time.
You don't write,
you don't call, you don't, I don't know what's going on with you. It's like everything going crazy. You're still in the same secret bunker out in the playa there.
Yeah, it's underground, yet it's you can probably see the sky from here. So
okay, yeah. Well, I am back in Santa Monica at ZipRecruiter, and it's today, though, the weather is beginning what they call June gloom, which means that we've had really great spring and it's all kind of nice and pretty, and occasionally it rains, occasionally there's puffy clouds. Often there's blue sky, though, during the spring. But starting right about now, it's this horrible fog mixed with clouds, mixed with everything. And it just, it, you know, for Californians do not like this kind of weather. So they call us the June gloom. So, yay. Anyway, and if you saw the video last week, you saw that I had taken a tumble when I was down at OSCON. And I had a really wonderfully nice black eye. It's fading. Definitely, if you can see the video, it's definitely fading. Sorry for grossing anyone out there if you're watching the video, but I'm very happy about that. And maybe another couple of weeks, I won't have anything to show for it except maybe a tiny scar. So that's how that goes. But the show's not about us. The show's not about where we're coming from. The show is actually about the cool projects that we get to bring on all the time. This week, no exception. This is going to be Varnish Cache. Varnish is actually a reverse HTTP proxy. Contemporaneously have come up with anything harder to say than www and HTTP. That's darn you. Anyway, so the way this works is say you have a website and you think it's going to get a lot of hits. And sometimes you have pages that are dynamic and they have to compute things. But it's typically computing the same thing over and over again. Like you have some templating that maybe only a small part of it varies, or none of it varies at all. And you end up doing the same computations on the server over and over again. And so what Varnish does is it sits between you and the clients that are visiting your website and tries to determine if you're going to get back exactly the same text again. And if so, it remembers that text. And so the next time somebody requests that same pseudo-dynamic page, because often that's how it comes out, Varnish just serves it right up. And there's a lot of projects in this area. You might use Apache for this, Apache MonProxy. You might use Nginx, things like that. There's a lot of caching solutions out there. But Varnish was sort of born out of the woodwork that was there and has some interesting, unique features, which I don't know anything about yet, but I know somebody that will be able to tell us, and that's Per Buer. I probably mispronounced his name. I apologize for that. We're going to bring him on in a few minutes, but Guillermo, what do you have to say about this?
I think you covered all the bases. In fact, I think Per will not have many things to talk about now.
I'm sure he'll have plenty of things to talk about. Definitely plenty of things to talk about. But, you know, I asked around, and my last three clients used Varnish. This this client, though, built up their own thing with Apache Mod Perl because they were familiar with that. And, you know, when you're in a Perl shop, then doing things with Mod Perl is really sort of convenient. But they've looked at some of the solutions, too. And sometimes we get the same sort of leverage out of having a CDN. And we'll talk about the difference between this between what you do with Varnish, what you do with the CDN, or how you get them to work together. That's another one of the questions I want to ask them. So enough of me rambling. I do have a little bit of business to do before we get started with the show. Because whether you're developing an app, a website, or working on a server-based project, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. DigitalOcean offers Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed easily to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything else you can think of with full root access. This helps you get your project off the ground quickly and makes it easy to scale when you find success. DigitalOcean is used by over 600,000 developers, including me. I've been a very happy DigitalOcean customer for a little over a year and a half, and I've bumped into a lot of the DO guys at OSCON a couple weeks ago. I really appreciate them coming up to me and saying, hey, thanks for helping talk about us on your show. You can deploy and configure your droplets via a streamlined control panel or simple API. You can choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. And that's what attracted me to that, because finally, something in the cloud that's supporting FreeBSD, my favorite OS. You can select from one of many pre-configured one-clicks like Drupal, Docker, or Node.js to get up and running quickly or build the exact infrastructure you need, with root access to servers running 100% SSDs in state-of-the-art data centers around the world. It's highly scalable to meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. You can also use advanced features like floating IPs for high availability, private networking, and automated deployments via API. There's an extremely active community with a large and detailed set of tutorials on all the ways you can use your droplet. Want to configure a LAMP server, set up a virtual desktop or VPN? They've got you covered. And it's so easy to get started. You can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. Hard to believe, but I've seen it happen multiple times. DigitalOcean is incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 a month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit for free. And we thank DigitalOcean for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Per, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Yeah, it's your turn.
Yes. Yes. Well, thanks for bringing me on. Okay. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Great. Yes. And where are you speaking to us from?
Yes. So I'm in Oslo, Norway.
Mm-hmm.
Where the company that I work for, we're based. So that's our R&D operation that runs out of Oslo.
And so what time is it? Like 7 p.m. or something? Somewhere around
there? It's 6:40.
Nice guess. Hey, I know time zones. I keep telling my friends I'm a time zone geek. Yes, and so this is actually the second time we meet, because we were actually both together on one of my wonderful, they called them geek cruises back then. They're called Insight Cruises now. That's where the website is for going to see what they are. It was Linux, the Linux Lunacy in 2001, where we got a bunch of people on a ship together, and we talked a lot about various open source things, Linux things, and all sorts of wonderful stuff. So did you ever figure out the name of the drink that we were drinking together? Was it probably a Wang Wang?
Yeah, it was a Wang Wang. Yeah.
The Wang Wang became the battle cry for the first three or four cruises, so that was really cool. Well, again, I digress. We could talk about that all day, too. Yeah. So, but let's go ahead and give us the 30,000-foot view. What problem is Varnish trying to solve?
I think you described it really well. I mean, you have all these application servers, and there are Perl and Python and Java ones, and they are all, I mean, they're extremely generic pieces of software, and they do sort of all kinds of stuff. And they will typically sort of end up with the sort of latencies in maybe 70 to 300 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. So, and that's quite a lot, actually, when you sort of consider that a server might have 12 cores and sort of, so you can't really do that many requests per second in parallel if you sort of just if you just assume that you're spending that that server time being 100% busy. Mm-hmm. And what Varnish does is basically just keep this response in memory, and then sort of if it, as you described it, if it deems it appropriate to sort of respond with a cached response, it'll basically mm-hmm. just sort of take a piece of memory and just dump it onto the socket, and that can typically sort of take 30 to 40 microseconds. And if you compare 30 to 40 microseconds to 70 to 300 milliseconds, that's quite a bit faster. So we are typically talking about sort of speed ups of like 1,000x or something.
And the big problem here, help me confirm this for me. The big problem here is that we don't want two different solutions to pages that need to be assembled because they have a header and a footer that's in common, and maybe standard styles for things. We don't want to use two different tools for that versus an actual page that needs to be different every time dynamically. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not entirely sure what other alternative would be. Are you talking about? Are you talking about sort of caching in the application?
No, I'm talking more about using a tool that. I'm most familiar with like Template Toolkit because that's the Perl way of doing this. So you can use Template Toolkit sort of to assemble pages from templates that never change. And so you could actually do it. There's actually tools to do this. Pre-assemble a bunch of pages. In that case, it would have delivered at the same speed as caching it somewhere. Well, maybe not quite the same, but close. And versus using Template Toolkit to look at the incoming CGI parameters and that sort of thing and actually generate a different page every time.
Absolutely. So now and understand what you're referring to. So of course, yes, an alternative would be sort of to sort of pre-generate these static pages, and then sort of deliver them from disk using Apache or Nginx or something like that. That could be an alternative. Sort of performance-wise, they're more or less the same. Varnish has this theoretical sort of opportunity to be a bit faster because it doesn't have to go through the file system and sort of. I bet that it only sort of needs to just sort of dump stuff from memory, but then again, that's really not significant anyway. But I mean the nice thing about this is Varnish will keep all this in memory, and you can sort of so there's stuff that you can do since we have this in memory. You can, for instance, maybe you have like different variants to depending on language preferences and such, and Varnish will sort of keep those things organized and sort of serve up the right version. Whereas doing that with pre-rendered pages on disk is slightly harder. And there are other examples as well. Varnish could do some authentication and authorization and sort of then deliver from memory. So there's sort of Varnish has quite a bit of I would say they're more flexible. There's a lot more flexibility when we do it with Varnish than compared to dumping these pre-rendered pages onto disk.
Yeah, I want to get more into that in a second, but I just also want to make sure that our audience is with us about where this fits in the chain. I think reverse proxy cache might mean something to about a third of our audience, but I want to include the other two-thirds. So what you would do is you would have your company name, example.com, rather than that address go directly to your web server, you would then point this at your Varnish instance. Now, Varnish has to know how to really to get to the web server, so there's an internal configuration for that. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. That's completely spot on. So we sometimes call it like an edge server, like it sits at the edge of your network. But there's lots of different ways to. I think like V3C refers to the as surrogate web cache is also another name for it, or surrogate web server. So that the client will talk to the surrogate and the surrogate talk to the actual web server, which is sometimes also referred to as the origin. So nomenclature is confusing. Yeah.
Okay. So at a minimum, to get Varnish up and running, I have to install it somewhere. And is it just typing in the origin address, or are there other things I need to figure out to even just get that's basically helping me a little bit?
No, I think, I mean, you. So let's say that you go into the port tree and then you type install Varnish, and then sort of it all sort of automatically shows up. You have a configuration file. You edit that configuration file. You tell what the sort of the host name and the port where Varnish can get the content, and then you can start it up, and it sort of will start working. So that's the absolute minimum configuration, and not really that useful in real life, but it might do help you with a thing or two.
And so, what can you add to that? What you started to list some of the features, but talk to me about some of the ones that people use the most. How are they extending this?
Yeah, so I mean, like 20 years ago, the web was really, really simple. You just sort of would request stuff and sort of, and HTTP wasn't really that different from FTP or sort of the other sort of file transfer protocols. Since then, we had things such as cookies. So cookies, of course, is very, very wary of cookies. It can sort of, if a client sort of requests something and the client has a cookie, Varnish has no way to actually know if that cookie is just something that's there by accident, or if the outcome of the request that it previously has cached as a response was dependent on that cookie.
Ah, yeah.
So Varnish doesn't know this. So the default policy of Varnish, and sort of it's written defensively, is sort of if the client has a cookie, we just sort of don't cache anything. We don't deliver anything from cache at all. So, of course, there probably isn't a sort of a web domain that doesn't have any sort of cookies associated to it. So even though the web server doesn't actually need the cookies at all, because, I mean, you have these Google Analytics cookies, those sort of show up everywhere. They're not really needed for anything that sort of the backend web server does. They're just there because it's a convenient way to store some state on the client side, and they show up in a lot of the HTTP transactions. So you need some configuration to sort of suppress these cookies and just basically tell Varnish that it can safely throw them away, and then it will disregard the cookies and then will reserve cache. So that's the most, I think, common thing, configuration item that people do.
Okay, great. Lost my train of thought. Now I do that occasionally here. Guillermo, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. You know, I was actually interested in letting other people know what the you mentioned you can have this in the memory, right? You know, have all your cache files in memory. Is there an alternative to this? Can you use maybe, it would probably defeat the purpose, maybe using a CDN to store maybe files that aren't really used that much, or perhaps just using a standard old hard drive to store the files that don't get called back so much? Or how does the actual file system work for this?
Yeah, so I mean, Varnish was written with sort of caching to actually, it was actually using disk to cache. It was one of sort of its really cool features back in the day. We're just sort of using just what's technically referred to as memory backed storage, or memory mapped storage, which is a sort of virtual memory that's sort of backed by a file. And then the kernel operating system kernel would just sort of make stuff go onto disk and into memory whenever it needed to. That actually didn't work that well, so we sort of stepped away from that and just started just using regular memory. And it turns out sort of today, memory is really, really cheap, and people don't usually have that much content. I mean, if you take a site like the New York Times, and you take like the all the content that they've published for the last month, including all the pictures, that's probably not that many gigabytes of content. I mean, I don't know how many people they are, but I mean, it's actually not that many gigabytes. And like, you can get servers today with 128 or more, and they're not really that expensive. So actually sort of wasting a bit of memory, or using, I wouldn't say waste, using memory to sort of cache to keep stuff in to make sure that it's delivered quickly is actually not that it's not that luxurious anymore. So I would sort of gladly spend that. I mean, the only thing that sort of you can't really cache in memory is video. If you're doing video, you definitely want to sort of leverage disk.
And we have a question from the chat room here. The Andromedan, I hope I said that one right. How do you configure Barnish to recognize statically generated content from per user generated content? I'm guessing he means that, say, if I, you know, if we have more generated content, but maybe with a name in it, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, is there a way?
Yeah, absolutely. So let me just sort of wind a bit back. And there's a couple of sort of things you need to know for this all to make sense, if you're not familiar with Varnish. So the first thing is Varnish does not have a traditional configuration file. It doesn't have this Apache or Nginx style configuration, which is basically just a sort of a key value document where you sort of set these properties. Varnish doesn't have that. Varnish has this policy file where you write policies on how transactions are being treated. So if you ever done sort of SQL databases and you dealt with triggers, that's probably the sort of closest thing that sort of resembles these policies the most. So in these policies, you do stuff like you can set up things like if the client IP address matches this pattern and there is a cookie which is called user and it contains Merlin, then do this. And you can sort of do so it's basically a programming language that sort of lets you define these policies. And what Varnish does is that when you start it up and you sort of load a configuration file, it will, transpile that configuration file into C code and then run that C code through GCC or Clang and to make it into binary code. And then that binary code gets loaded and then it gets executed. So basically just sort of programming Varnish to behave the way you want. So it's slightly different because you don't have these properties that you turn on and off, but you end up with something that's very sort of very, very, I would say, flexible. So you can do things like if the client accepts GSIP and is originating within California and blah, 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 then do this. If not, then do that. So instead of having so that's the way Varnish is configured. And it's the thing that's rather unique to Varnish. So back when we sort of did the first release, which is 10 years ago, we were sort of hoping actually that sort of other people would think this is cool and sort of maybe sort of pick up the pattern and sort of deploy it in their own open source projects. But nobody's done that. So we're sort of a bit miffed because I still actually sort of am amazed on how our users are able to sort of leverage this and do really, really cool stuff with it. A good example here is sort of the New York Times, for instance. Their whole paywall logic is actually implemented in this Varnish layer. So it's written actually in this configuration language. So actually Varnish sort of, their Varnish servers, which are in front of the web servers, when you request a page from their web, the Varnish will actually evaluate that request, look up your subscriber information, check out if you have a valid subscription, and if that subscription entitles you to that content, and if everything is okay, it will sort of release that content from cache. if it's not okay, it'll probably meter the request or give you this, please log in or buy a subscription or something. You also use that to sort of define the sort of high watermark on sort of how complex you can actually make these configurations. I don't think there's actually makes sense to sort of go beyond that, but it sort of gives you an idea of how expressive the configuration can be.
Okay. Well, I do see that it would actually make Varnish a little bit more tailored to what you want to do, and I do like the way you kind of worked in that configuration bit there, because especially if you do want to get something for, say, like you mentioned, the New York Times or, you know, any other big name out there, they have some really really specific uses they might want to get out of Varnish that are not just going to be cookie cutter. I just want this only the static content from the front page to be static, and everything else is just going to be dynamic, and it just wouldn't really work for them, would it? But I do kind of find this a lot really interesting. Something you mentioned that maybe somebody could get in there and modify it. What license are you guys using?
Two clause BSD license, so basically as free as you can get.
Oh, that's good.
Free BSD license.
No, yeah, I know. I'm sure Randall's going to love that one too, because he's a big FreeBSD fan too.
I can just sort of, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
The chief architect is Paul Enenkamp, which I think has written the Geom system in FreeBSD, which is some part of the storage bits. And also, I think he wrote the initial memory allocator and also the MD5 algorithm, or the MD5 not the algorithm, the MD5 implementation that was in FreeBSD. So he's our sort of chief architect. So he works, I think, exclusively on FreeBSD, by the way. So Varnish, at least initially, Varnish was very sort of FreeBSD centric. It's a bit more balanced today, but yeah.
Well, since you mentioned FreeBSD, of course, I'm jumping back in here for a second. And I recognize some of the names on Varnish from the FreeBSD community, so that's probably why I thought they overlapped a little bit, which is cool. I want to take it a slightly different direction, though. We keep talking about how does the server manage that this is a new page versus this might be a repeat of a page that I sent before. I think one of the things that takes care of that is if the server is generating, the origin server, sorry, is generating mm-hmm. something called an e-tag, and I presume Varnish supports that?
Yeah, Varnish supports that. So, of course, if it has an e-tag, it's all very simple. The alternatives would be that the origin server sends along cache control header, which gives basically the object a time to live. So it says to Varnish, you're allowed to keep this for 300 seconds, and then you have to discard it. That would be an alternative. There's also some sort of, that's a whole sort of spectrum of stuff that sort of goes with freshness. There's also a lot of sort of negotiations that can be done between Varnish and the client. So for instance, let's say that you want Varnish to sort of keep different variants based on language preferences or something, then this awful slightly magic header called vary, HTTP vary, comes into effect, which lets Varnish create variants of a page depending on the client header, which is a slightly odd concept to wrap your mind around.
Is there some sort of API where I could say, I know all the content under this directory has now changed, so please uncache yourself from the Varnish?
Not out of the box, there isn't. There is, actually. I forgot about one. So the topic that you're raising there is sort of the one of the really big ones inside of the Varnish community. It's called cache invalidation. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember who said that the two different two difficult things in computer science. One is cache invalidation, and the other is naming things. And I mean, who hasn't spent like a week or so debugging a cache invalidation problem? So there's tons of ways to sort of invalidate content from cache. Varnish there is the easiest one to understand is you have something called a purge request. That's basically where instead of you saying to the web server get slash foo, you say purge slash foo. And Varnish will have a look at that request, and then there might be some checks to see if you are allowed to actually issue such a call. And if you're allowed, then Varnish will basically just sort of zap that piece of content. So that's really simple. But that means that you have to do one such call for every object that you want to delete. And if you want to do sort of a mass delete, that might be a bit inconvenient. So there's something called a ban. I'm not really happy with the naming. So that again plays into the two hard problems in computer science. And naming things is actually really hard. Because when you call something a ban, a lot of people seem to associate that with sort of keeping people away from the server. But it actually sort of, for us, it's actually a sort of a banning content from cache. So yeah. Slightly confusing. But what you can do is you can execute a command on the Varnish server there where you can give it a pattern, and that pattern will then be applied to all the pieces of content that are in the memory. And if it matches, those will be deleted. And that could be used to sort of delete everything that's under slash foo.
Yeah, this whole notion of cache invalidation is definitely a tough thing. The other way to say your cache statement there is your website's running too slow. So you go, I know, I'll use a cache. Now you have two problems.
Yes.
So, yeah, for ZipRecruiter here, one of the problems we had was we were going out to the real database way too often, and MySQL, not really a database. But anyway, it's still pretty bad for the kind of stuff we were trying to do it. And so I started – they already had a memcached, which has its own set of problems. But I worked out about 17 different ways because you can't put Dybbuk class row objects into memcached. It doesn't serialize and deserialize properly. So I had also caches that were only in memory because then I could actually cache the object. And then I told people, please start, stop making it an object, make it a key value pair or something. That way you can actually use the shared cache across all processes and stuff. Anyway, I could go on forever about this, but I for a while there I had as my tagline internally, we'll cache for cache.
So. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the use cases for Varnish is that you are able to sort of simplify the caching infrastructure behind Varnish.
Yep. Okay.
So that if you have like a setup where a reasonably fast application server and a memcache, and even though memcache is really about as fast as you can get, you're still like a 1 millisecond latency on sort of getting figuring out a key, resolving an object. I can't remember, but approximately a millisecond, I guess, on a local area network. And that's still quite a lot compared to sort of, what is it, like 12 nanoseconds for a memory lookup?
Yep.
So you can't really do like tens of thousands of memcache queries when you render a page. You're limited to only doing quite a few. And some people have sort of been using Varnish or, again, I guess similar technology to sort of get rid of all that and sort of simplify their applications and more or less making their application stateless. And I mean, stateless application is sort of this really dream for a developer to debug because you just feed it the same input data and it will act exactly the same every time. And sort of with Varnish, you can sort of, you're more likely to be able to have such an application survive production. Because if you if you don't have any caching at all, then yeah, it probably will not be able to deliver many responses per second.
So there are some overlapping features between Varnish and typical CDN setup. When would you reach for a CDN? When would you reach for Varnish? And would there ever be use cases for both?
Yeah, I mean, Varnish powers a few CDNs. So I think this will still in some part go out over CacheFly. And I think CacheFly has been using Varnish for a bit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. But sort of the CDN, so that's a content distribution network. So if the distribution part is what you're after in a CDN, so if you are sort of pushing content out of California and you have a global audience and you don't really want to fly to the world and set up a bunch of servers, you just sort of leverage a CDN to do that. And they will sort of disseminate the content all across the globe. And they will do that for you. And that's really sort of very, very efficient. So I think if the distribution part is important, then sort of CDN is the way to go. But CDNs don't necessarily perform as well as your servers might do, basically because they are multi-tenant, they're shared infrastructure. So the server that caches your stuff is also caching stuff for 10,000 other companies. And probably your stuff will not be pinned in memory, whereas with your own Varnish server, you can pin stuff in memory. I see quite a few examples of sort of people going away from using CDN and actually getting increased performance, basically just because they've been able to use Varnish and then sort of pin stuff in memory, and that meant a reduction in page load times in a limited geographical area. So let's say that you're in France or something. I mean, France is not really that big. And if you have a server in Paris, chances are you should probably be able to serve content from that server if your network is decent to the whole of France, probably faster than a CDN, or at least not very comparable, and a lot cheaper as well. So there are, but then again, if you want to reach the globe from Paris, then of course connections from California to Paris are probably horrible.
Cool. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's. I think that's. That should be it.
Okay. Okay. This show has been. I'm just noticing now, reviewing the questions we've asked, this show has been incredibly geeky. What I want to also talk about is Varnish, the open source project, versus Varnish software. So, Can you tell me the relationship between the two?
Yeah. So it started out as an open source project. Back in 2005, sort of, it was initiated. And basically, a lot of sort of stuff happened during the dot-com bust. A lot of money sort of ran away from sort of IT infrastructure. And a lot of projects got refocused. There was a lot of sort of initiatives that dealt with scaling internet stuff back in around 2000, and they all disappeared within a couple of years. So around 2003, 2004 was really, really pain in the back to scale a website because basically the tools were sort of disappearing actually because products were being end of life. And there was this Norwegian newspaper. So Norway is this weird country where sort of news is extremely important. And I think at the time, this was in 2005, I think they had a daily peak of like 1.2 gigabits or something, which is quite a lot considering there's sort of 4 or 5 million people in Norway. But anyway, they decided that the world needs this new thing. And they commissioned some developers. Paul Henning Kamp was there. A company I was working for at the time also got involved. We did the initial Linux port of it. And we created this open source project. I was sort of, we had 37 downloads, I think, the first for the beta release that we had. Yeah, I think we're around, I don't know, 20,000 a week or something now, which is quite a bit more.
Yeah.
The project sort of lived on, and it grew this really sort of steady following of the people. Basically, a lot of people fell in love with this weird configuration style, this sort of policy-driven configuration. And so built this loyal customer or user base. And then 2008, it sort of became common knowledge that both Facebook and Twitter were using Varnish. And back in 2008, sort of Facebook and Twitter were sort of really cool companies. Today, they're a bit like old farts. Mm. Facebook also did spectacularly well when dealing with how they scaled. I mean, they had this huge growth and they were never down. So people heard that Varnish has something to do with that. Then they got a lot of interest around Varnish. And sort of so around 2008, sort of usage exploded. And then at some point, it was getting really sort of more and more cumbersome to sort of finance development and sort of packaging. And also 2008, you had a sort of financial crisis, and the business I was running was sort of actually trying to do a bit of consulting, and then we sort of doing this Varnish thing in between. It wasn't really working out too well. So we decided basically to start up a company to sort of support Varnish. And that company got started in 2010. Late 2010, I would say. So now 5.5 or 6 years later, soon 6 years later, it's a sort of, I think we are around 40 people now. Mm. And sort of our business is basically is just stuff that's all around Varnish. There's not really that much opportunity for consulting, so we don't really do that. And besides, I'm not really too much of a fan of doing consulting. It's like if you have a gig like you where you sort of have this sort of steady client and you can stay there for 4 months, that's great, that works. But with Varnish, sort of, yeah, it's really hard to sort of do something, configure Varnish and spend more than 2 weeks doing it. So you can't really, there's not that much opportunity for consulting. So we have basically gone, I would say, slightly unpopular open core route, where we have a sort of special version of Varnish where we sort of put some features that we did not release as open source. So we have some. So, for instance, I mentioned video caching of videos earlier. The proprietary version we have is sort of better at that because it handles larger data volumes a lot better. So we decided to sort of pick out our sort of niche of the market and sort of try to charge for that. So hopefully that seems to work out okay.
Have there been any open source implementations of the stuff that you've got under lock and key?
No, not that. No. We've done something different than I think a few other things. We did the stuff that we have done proprietary is really hard. So it's really, you have to spend a couple of years doing it.
Okay.
So I don't think anyone wants to invest that because it doesn't make sense. It's just a lot cheaper to sort of buy it from us.
Okay, and what kind of commits are you getting from outside Varnish software against the Varnish cache project?
Yeah, so there's some commits. There's also one thing. There's Pollen and Comp, PHK, which you know if you've been tracking sort of FreeBSD development earlier. So he doesn't work in the company. So that's basically the sort of, we have this basically we have a bit like an editorial setup where we the business side and he's the editorial side, and there's a sort of a firewall between us. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't do anything to do with sort of commercial the proprietary bits, whereas we will actually I think we spend most of our time actually on open source bits. So it's and so a lot of the commits are either from us or from him, and then there are I would say maybe 5-6 people around the globe that sort of commit to the project regularly. It's not really the easiest thing in the world to sort of just sort of casually pick up. It's written in C, and even though C is quite common, this is massively multi-threaded, tons of sort of lockless data structures and stuff. So it's you have to know what you're doing in order to be able to produce something that's makes sense. I would say that you probably need that. Unless it's a trivial bug, you know, to actually contribute a feature, you probably need to spend 3 months warming up before doing that.
I mean, that stuff is really difficult. It actually says that it's threaded, no event loop. Threads work, don't believe the hype. Can you explain that?
Mm. Yeah. So that was back in 2010. There was this paper called the C10K problem. How to deal with 10,000 simultaneous clients. And I think a lot of the discussion, at least I can't remember if it was in the actual article or in the discussion around it, or probably Hacker News or something. But it was basically common belief that the only architecture that could scale would be an event loop. Mm-hmm. So event-driven programming is basically where instead of having threads, you just sort of set up, you handle incoming stuff as events, and you sort of fire off callbacks. And this means that you can have one thread, one process, handle something like 10,000 connections. And that sort of it performs extremely well, but it's quite complex to maintain, and there are some problems associated with it as well. Varnish didn't do that, so we basically just said we're going to use one thread per client. We got a lot of flack for that initially, and people said this is not going to work, not going to scale, but it actually has scaled really well. a lot of the reason I think for it scaling is there was both in Linux and FreeBSD quite a lot of work spent on the threading. I think in Linux, it was the new POSIX threading library, which was a major feature of the 2.6 kernel. And that had like a really lightweight thread subsystem. So you could spawn like 80,000 threads in like, 100 milliseconds or something. So that's why we threaded.
You know, it's interesting. I had Nginx on the show last year, I think it was, or maybe a year before, and it'd be interesting to get the two of you in a debate, just to really, except you'd probably just shout at each other. That wouldn't be any good. It'd be like,
I meet quite a few people from Nginx from time to time. I mean, we go to the same places, and I mean, it's not like Postgres versus MySQL. It's actually a lot quite friendly, actually. Nginx is I'm a, to some extent, as long as you don't use it for caching, I'm a big fan of Nginx. I mean, they've done a lot of stuff right. It's our preferred web server, so we use it quite a bit.
Well, it has a lot of great plugins to do all sorts of things. I mean, you could effectively do Apache Mod Perl using Nginx, which is pretty cool. So anyway, I also wanted to cover a couple more quick things. We're running out of time, unfortunately. There's so much to talk about with this, so I could go on for another hour, but I don't have another hour according to Twit. So, but I did want to cover what's on the roadmap, what's coming up, and do you need assistance with some of this stuff?
Yeah, so there's one big thing that's happening, we're moving away from HTTP 1, or we're not moving away from HTTP 1.1, but we are moving to HTTP 2.0, or H/2 as it's being referred to.
Okay.
So that's a significant change for the project. It's sort of been in the back of our minds for I think 5 years now. This was going to happen at some point. And a lot of the sort of, I think the two last major releases have been all about sort of preparing to it. But HTTP is, for me, I have this sentimental thing with HTTP 1. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but like when I was studying, I bought Client Web Programming was an O'Reilly book. It was really a very thin O'Reilly book. The goal of that book was to teach you how to talk to web servers and how to, I think by the end of the book, you've written a sort of a little Perl client that would sort of connect to your local news sources, fetch the latest newscast and the weather and blah, 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 and display that on your computer, and then sort of play a song so it would wake you up. And I did that. I remember sort of this fascination of actually just telnetting in onto port 80 on the server and then typing /, and then the server would talk back. And I was so fascinating with it because it was this thing that I've just sort of had no idea. It was completely opaque to me. And then you can actually talk the protocol yourself. And that's going away, by the way, in HTTP 2. It's now a binary frame protocol, so it's about as easy to talk HTTP 2 as it is to talk Ethernet, which is pretty hard. But it will require a sort of significant sort of rewrite of everything that talks to the client and quite a lot of the backend. There's a lot of now there'll be concurrency, so the clients will now. The web browsers will now, instead of opening 8 connections or how many they do, it will now open 1 connection, and every bit of data will be multiplexed onto that connection using this binary framing protocol. And of course, that whole thing is quite complex. It's something we're working on. I don't know if. I don't think it's something we would actually need help with. If you have implemented HTTP 2.0 in another product and have some valuable lessons, then. But it's quite a slog. I think this work would be quite work intensive.
Yep. So well, as long as I can get. Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I think so on the roadmap, that's the basically the only thing that matters for us. I mean, there's tons of small stuff as well. Lots of user contributed stuff as well. We have module support, by the way, so you can sort of people write their own modules, and so we have all sorts of weird connectivity modules, text transformations, all that. That's being still sort of there are developments daily, but
Well, as long as SOCAT supports H2, I don't care that it's binary. Are you familiar with SOCAT? It's like NetCat on steroids.
Oh no, I'm not.
Oh! Once you discover it, it'll be the first thing you install in every new box. It can generate an HTTP connect request. As part of what it knows how to do. So you can actually, I've used it to bend corners around firewalls. Ooh, did I say that loud? No, I don't. I mean, I've used it just to play around. Well, as you might imagine, being in all the different places I teach and work, I kind of have to be creative occasionally to get back to my home system. Yeah, SoCat is amazing. Go check it out. We need to do a show on SoCat. I think I have it on my long list. We're almost out of time, and I keep taking more time because I keep getting distracted by the cool stuff you're talking about. I'll just start. Just tell me if any of this is wrong. This is on GitHub. That's where you do your tracking for the open source side of it. Easy to install packages for everybody. Okay, good. So all the normal things about a good, mature software, a good, mature open source software. Do you have the best practices badge yet from last week's show? Oh, I bet you don't. Go watch two shows ago. We talked with people in the infrastructure stuff, and it actually gives you a list of things you should go through and, as a checklist to make sure you've done all those in terms of being secure and minimum bit length, things like that. And then you put a badge on your website. So go watch the show from like two episodes ago, something like that, maybe three. Yeah. I am in a blur. I have no idea how this else goes. Okay. Is there anything we didn't get to, keeping in mind we're almost out of time, anything we didn't get to that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
Yeah, I mean, there's one architectural bit that I didn't mention at all. Varnish doesn't log to files. It logs to memory, which I think is really cool, and everyone should do this. If they do, I think NSA would have more issues tracking data, but we don't log to a log file. We just log to a piece of memory in a circular manner, and when you need the logs, you attach a client to that memory buffer, and then you stream you get the stream of the logs. You can persist all the logs if you want to, but the default policy is not to log everything to disk.
Okay, that's great. And I got two questions I have to ask everybody, or I get my audience yelling at me. What's your favorite text editor?
Emacs.
Yay! One for our side.
Okay. In 2001, on this cruise boat you referred to earlier, I had this class, was called Learning Emacs, and it was with Richard Stallman. It was a four-hour sort of thing where Richard Stallman did his, now kids, you're going to learn Emacs.
Nice.
And then I think the following day, he also did an introductory course to Emacs Lisp, which was really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. One of the things about Emacs is a little bit of me in every copy of the chips because I wrote the Emacs Lisp pretty printer. So the thing that takes it from a flat S expression to where it's always indented nicely. I wrote that, and Richard liked it so much he included it as part of the distro. So that was cool. Nice. My little claim to fame there. Yeah. Okay, again, randomly talking. Let's go with the other one. I bet I'm not going to like the next answer. Your favorite scripting language?
Oh, you know, it's Perl.
No, you're kidding. No, double header. All right.
I started off with Perl. I mean, I actually started off by buying your book, Randall, back in 96 or something.
I made a
learning
buck off.
Perl, which was Perl 4 or something.
Yeah.
And I spent my formative years programming Perl.
Nice.
And today I don't really program that much, but whenever I need this sort of quick and dirty stuff, it's still in my fingers. All the sort of where line noise, dereferencing hashes and everything, it's sort of not going away. It's still very sort of stuck in my mind.
Well, even though there's still Perl mode in Emacs, you should always replace it with C Perl mode. It's much better at getting the indenting right most of the time, so... Just a tip for our Perl and Emacs people out there, of which you're the first one in like months. C Perl mode. Just Google for C Perl mode, and they'll tell you how to use to replace the built-in Perl mode, because that built-in one just sucks. I don't even know why it's still there. Well, Per, it's been wonderful having you on. Again, we could talk for another hour. Lots of stuff still to cover. More things about configuration, for example, or most unusual uses Varnish, and biggest installation of Varnish, actually one of the ones I wanted to get to. But we ran out of time. We were on this tech stuff. And anyway, but I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking to us in the limited time we had about Varnish.
Thank you. Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Very good. That was Per Buer talking, and I don't know if I pronounced the name right again, talking to us from halfway around the world, talking about Varnish. What do you think there, Gamma?
Well, we did miss the usual, you know, use for varnish, which is you know, covering wood.
Yeah. Okay, that's okay.
That's great. I really like this project.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look more at it. You know, I remember like they were using it at Media Temple. They were using it what's the next thing I work for? NAMI Media. I've forgotten already. You know, it's been a while. Been a while since I've been to either of those companies. So Media Temple's still around. NAMI got bought out and destroyed. But that's the way it goes sometimes. All right. So we've got some upcoming guests. We've got a couple new ones, actually. Like I said last week, because I was at OSCON in Austin, got to talk to a lot of people and got a lot of press releases. So I've been turning these press releases into new shows. Coming up next week, I'm excited about this. You know, we talk about GitLab all the time, but what do we know about behind the scenes and, you know, how they're doing with stuff, what's on their roadmap, all that stuff. So we have one of their senior guys, unfortunately I didn't know which one it is going to be coming on the show, talking about GitLab, the past, the future, maybe some interestingly large statistics, things like that. Following that, DataStax, which is a Cassandra NoSQL database with a lot of wrapper around it to make it all really cool. Biturgia, which is software development analytics. So you can see the velocity of your project, see how many bugs are being cleared out every day and things like that. Lisk, which is not Lisp, it's a K, is a JavaScript-based sidechain application for the cloud. Now, sidechain blockchain stuff, that's all related to the, like, Bitcoin. It's like an instance of that. It's not all of it. It's like an instance of that. And then, but they're, okay, so they're going to come on and talk about that. And apparently what they're doing is real innovative. But, of course, they always tell me that in their press release, so we'll see. Just added to the schedule is Aurelia, which is... if you've heard of Angular, if you've heard of React, if you've heard of these JavaScript frameworks that when you change a variable over here, it automatically updates some HTML over there. This is another one of those. But what I find interesting is it's actually done by a couple of former guys who were working on AngularJS when it looked like Angular 2.0 wasn't moving along fast enough. So they kind of started over, made it simpler, but it basically fits the same space as Angular, but done right, they said. I don't know what that means. But, of course, they're going to say that because they left the Angular team. And then following that, the Koha Library Information System, LucidWorks, which is all about searching content on your machines, just added also to the schedule. Another one that came from OSCON is Karina. Karina is out of Rackspace. That's a new project they're releasing. And they call it an easy-to-use, instant-on, native container environment. And they were talking about how no infrastructure. No, you don't get away with that. You have to have some infrastructure. It doesn't just magically all show up. Something happens there, but they claim they with the lowest barrier to entry on that. But that's Chris Rackspace who said they want to sell more machines. You can find out all about this stuff on twitch.tv/floss. That's the homepage. Linked from there is my big spreadsheet. Again, I can always use more guests. And the way that happens is you have a project you want on the show. You email the project leader or the community coordinator and have them email me. My email address, merlin@stonehenge.com, is right on the twitch.tv homepage. So please do that. Send it along. We're opening up more and more of Q3. We've got about 5 or 6 empty slots right now. I'm still trying to fill those. We do a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twitch.tv. You can also watch the show in progress there. And we did take a number of questions, actually, from there today. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+, or at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+, and I am also Merlin on Twitter. So, although I don't pay a lot of attention to that. Okay, I'm coming up in 2 weeks at YAPSE North America, which is now retitled back to the Pearl Conference. That's in Orlando, Florida. Following immediately that, I'll be in San Francisco at the Red Hat Summit. So I'll find out more things Red Hat-ish. Then right after that, I'm going to be at Texas Linux Fest, right back to Austin. I am not going to go anywhere up 6th Street. I am not going to get another black eye in Austin. I can already tell. Or at least if I do, I'm going to be very careful with my cane. And then coming up in September, I'll be at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Hotlanta, Georgia, talking 4 or 5 talks on the EFF track and probably a couple talks on the podcasting track. That's everything I want to plug. Guillermo, anything you want to plug?
I guess people can follow me on Twitter. I am @GAMARAL. That's @GAMARAL. And you can also look for me on YouTube. I am not the DJ, but you know, you'll find me. There's my face all over the place, so it's okay.
Awesome. Well, thanks for jumping in at the last second again, Guillermo.
No problem.
We're actually We're actually looking at enrolling a couple more, maybe one or two more co-hosts, because it's slowly dwindled in size. I take responsibility for that, but I haven't had time to really do anything about it. I have heard a little birdie tweet in my ear, though, that somebody who's been absent from this show for about 6 months is very likely to come back within the next month or so. So that would be great. That would add another member to our rotating panel of co-hosts. If you don't know who that is, go back and listen about 9 months ago and 7 months ago, and then notice who's not here anymore. So anyway, we'll wish him well and wish him to get well soon, because he still has a little bit of challenge on that. All righty. Hey, Guillermo, thanks for jumping in there.
Yeah, no problem, man. Anytime, you know.
Great. We'll still have to finally get together for some tequilas next time I come into town. Like, we keep saying that, but we keep not doing it. So anyway, and as we always say at this time of the day, we'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.